Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, January 5th, 2025. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey. The share ID numbers for Friday, January 3rd, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,050, that's 22050. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,051, that's 22051. This morning, A Vision for You presents, let's get some answers to start 2025. We come to Overeaters Anonymous as a result of the suffering and the frustration we experienced in our disease of compulsive overeating. We felt hopelessness when we tried to control our problems with food and eating. We felt despair trying every diet and used many methods to control our compulsive overeating without success. We could not enjoy life because of our obsession with food and our weight. We could not stop eating too much, even when we really wanted to. We felt shame and a humiliation about our behavior with food. We cannot solve the problem by ourselves. We come to Overeaters Anonymous looking for a way out, looking for an answer, looking for a solution which will free us from the bondage of our affliction. The Big Book, written as a set of directions for doing the 12 steps quickly and effectively, was our answer. It's not a book of theory or philosophy. It offers a clear step-by-step approach for your recovery. It enables us to really and fully understand the twofold nature of our problem. It presents a clear, practical solution to the problem, and it shows us how to implement that solution through the 12-step program of action it clearly describes. The 12 steps, as outlined in the Big Book, represent a process of spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive overeating. We submit to a simple process that is not easy, yet it takes us to a place we've never been. Joining us this morning is Harlan G., a recovered compulsive overeater from Arizona. Harlan is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, a beloved member of A Vision for You, dedicated to enthusiastically carrying the message of recovery around the globe. It is always a privilege, an honor, and an absolute delight to welcome Harlan to the line. Good morning, Harlan. Oh,
good morning, Leah. Thank you so much. Gosh, how do I follow that, my Lord? Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here. 2025, can you believe it? Wow, I remember very well just struggling my whole life with food. I won't go into my whole biography, my whole story. I'm going to cut my story very short, and then let's throw it open for questions and answers. But just to give you an idea, I am a compulsive overeater, and I am one of those people who has been severely afflicted with this disease from birth. I was not one of those people that all of a sudden woke up one day in my 20s, 30s, 40s. I have been struggling with this my whole life. I have very vivid memories of doctors and teachers and adults, the parents of my friends, rabbis from Hebrew school. I remember them screaming at my parents, why are you letting them eat this? Why are you letting them eat that? Why are you letting them get so fat? And food was really my only solace in the storm. It was what leveled me out. It was something I sought out without knowing that there was an effect that I was eating over. The effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating certain foods. But once I ate those foods, I had no real knowledge of the physical allergy, that adverse abnormal reaction to the food, beverage, or substance, which made me eat against my will much, much, much more than I would have otherwise eaten. So if I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, searching for that effect that Dr. Silkworth describes so beautifully in the doctor's opinion of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am absolutely powerless over food, and my life is absolutely unmanageable. Again, in the interest of cutting it short, I came in here to Overeaters Anonymous at the age of 35 pounds as a senior in high school. I was 600 pounds by the time I graduated college. And when I was 24 years old, I had not reached my highest weight yet, which would be over 700 pounds. But I came in here by force, dragged by the ear by the mother of one of my friends, or several of my friends, who was more like a surrogate mom to me during my entire life. She's still alive. She's 92 years old. She lives 5 minutes from me here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we see each other all the time. But on February the 2nd, 1979, when I was just 24 years old, I was in, my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. It's been a long journey, and over the 45 years, I have been up and I have been down, but I have been to thousands and thousands of Overeaters Anonymous meetings, and to date, I'll just give you some statistics. I have lost a little over 500 pounds. I am in a weight now that my cardiologist is very happy with, my doctor is very happy with. I walk 3 miles a day, 6 days a week. My heart, my ejection fraction, my heart situation is very, very good. I just had some tests done on it, and I'm healthy at the moment. I want to live. I want to be part of life at last. And from very, very sad beginnings with this disease, I have a life today that is worth living. There were banks in Chicago that wouldn't have given me two dimes and a nickel for a quarter because I had written so many bad checks to cover the food costs and written so many bad checks for everything. I lied when the truth would have served me better in those days. I didn't know the truth from the false. I've had my car repossessed a couple of times. I lived a terrible, terrible life. Today, I have a wonderful life, and I have overwhelming evidence of a powerful and loving God in my life, that when I walk to God, He runs to me, and when I pray, He answers my prayers. Maybe not always in the way I want Him to, you know, I want this and I want that, but He answers my prayers, and He is so benevolent to me, it is not even funny. This is the easier, softer way for me and people like me. I love Overeaters Anonymous. It is my passion in life to serve Overeaters Anonymous with every fiber of my being until I can no longer do it. And God has imbued me with the ability to do so, and I'm so happy to serve God in this way. I love Overeaters Anonymous. I have a very special place in my heart for a vision for you. And I just want to say that in my opinion, in my travels through Overeaters Anonymous, a vision for you is the renaissance of OA. It is the rebirth of OA. It is bringing people back to the big book, bringing them back to a pure, simple recovery. And I just want to thank Leah for this opportunity. I want to thank Melanie and Leah, whose service, the sun never sets on their service, whose service will save millions and millions of people well beyond the scope of our life. And before I throw it open for questions and answers, I also can't speak without thanking one other person, and that's Roseanne Scholar, Roseanne S., whose service, again, the sun never sets. If you don't know who Roseanne is, Roseanne is the founder of Overeaters Anonymous. The very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous took place in Los Angeles, California on January the 19th, 1960. So on January the 19th, which is coming up here in 14 days, and I'm not good at math, so don't ask me any math questions, please. It'll be 65 years since Overeaters Anonymous was first founded, and I'm very grateful to be part of this magnificent movement, this magnificent organization. And to each and every one of you who calls in every day, you are my teachers, you are my professors. I owe you a debt of gratitude for pushing star one and sharing your life on the line every morning. I'm listening. I don't miss days. I'm listening. And you are my professors, and you are part and parcel to the reason that not only am I alive, but I have a life that is worth living. Leah, let's throw this open for questions and answers. I'm so honored to be here. Let's get started.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Thank you, Harlan, for sharing briefly your miraculous transformation, always an inspiring message of hope and possibility. We are going to open the line for questions. You can pose questions only this morning, please, in the interest of time, by pressing star one to unmute. I need your first name, including the first letter of your last name.
Judith S.P.
Judith S.P.
Janice P.M.
Good morning, Janice.
Good morning.
Star one to unmute. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your first name.
Star M.
Okay. Got Cheryl M. Anyone
Lisa
else?
O.
Lisa O.
Nancy L.
Nancy L. Okay, well, let's warm up. I'm sorry, didn't catch you.
Jeannie B.
Gotcha. Anyone else in this group?
Deb S.
Deb S. Okay, let's get started with this group. I have Judith S.P., Janice P.M., Cheryl M., Lisa O., Nancy L., Jeannie B., and Deb S. Let's get started with Judith S.P., please.
Hi, good morning, Vision. Thank you, Leah, for your service, and Harlan for being available.
Thank you, Judith. What's your question this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Harlan. Judith, star one to unmute, please.
Hi, this is Judith S.P. from Maryland.
Yes, go ahead with
your
question.
Can you not hear me?
We can
I hear
now.
You, Judith. Yes, go ahead with your question, please.
Okay, thank you. This may be a rhetorical question. I've been struggling with self-bondage. I've worked the steps a number of times. I'm devoted to Vision. I spend time with God, and sometimes out of nowhere, whoops, there's my self-will. And sometimes it can be quieted when I turn to God. Other time I do some damage and I run rampant in my experience. My question to you is, how do you keep connected to God every moment?
Okay, well, let me ask you a question before I do anything. Judith, where are you currently in the step process? Are you abstinent?
I'm abstinent. I'm recovered. I've gone through the steps. I'm not doing the steps right now.
Oh, well, that's a very dangerous situation because unless I'm doing step 10, 11, and 12 every day on a daily basis, I am just dieting with group support. I have to sponsor. I have to make sure that I'm out there sponsoring. And what is very, very important for me to remember is if I want different, I have to do different. This is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. And for me, the way to keep my program green, to keep it fresh, to keep it enthused, is to be sponsoring other people. At the bottom of page 14 of the big book in Bill's story, this is Ebby's legacy. And when he talks about my friend, he says, my friend, Ebby, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. The principles are the steps. This thing that came out in the 90s or the 80s with the principle of this is hope and the principle of that was well after Bill and Bob were dead. So when he talks about the principles, he's talking about the steps. Particularly, was it imperative? What does imperative mean? Important above all else. To work with others as he had worked with me. And it doesn't sound like you're sponsoring anyone, and that's very dangerous. And if I'm not living in 10, 11, and 12, I'm really just dieting with group support. Let's finish the paragraph, and I think it'll illuminate my point. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Judith, I'll close this question out by saying again, if I want different, I have to do different. I would suggest reshuffling the deck. It sounds like you're not going in any direction but down in your program. I would suggest relooking at who's sponsoring you. Are you using your sponsor on an everyday basis? I would look at restarting and keep your program fresh by going through as quickly as you can and remembering that this is not something you just put away and finish. So if I've worked the steps, that means I'm dead. I work the steps while I'm alive. And if I'm not living in 10, 11, and 12, I'm just kidding myself. I'm on a diet with group support. Thanks, Judith. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Judith S.P. Next up with a question, Janice P.M.
And thank you, of course. thank you, of course. Yeah, my goodness. Good morning to you, Harland. My name is Janice P.M. I'm recovered, and I do live in Massachusetts. Could you tell us what is the difference between harms and hurts?
I don't know that there is a difference between a harm and a hurt. I'm not sure what the difference would be. If I've harmed you, I have injured you in some way. Maybe I've stolen from you. Maybe I have tried to besmirch your character in some way. Maybe I have done something that is of an injury to you. I don't know that there is a difference between a harm and a hurt. So I may have done something to hurt your feelings, and I'm just kind of searching for something. Maybe I said you've got bad breath or your feet smell or something like that. maybe that would be something that would be a hurt. But if I've done that, I still have to make an amends for it. So, Janice, you got me flat-footed here. I don't know that there is a difference between a harm and a hurt, and I don't really know what that would be. If it's something I've done to hurt you, if it's something I've done to harm you, I think they're synonymous, and I have to go and make amends for them. Sorry I can't be more helpful, but I don't think there is a difference between. I just think that I don't think I know. Bill went to a writing class, took writing classes before the book, and he learned in those writing classes, Janice, that you don't want to keep using the same word again and again and again. So in some places he calls them the steps. In some places he calls them the principles. In one place, in the doctor's opinion, they're called rules. So he uses different words to make the same point, but I don't think there is a difference really between a harm and a hurt. Thanks.
Thank you, Janice, for your question. And Cheryl M., your turn to pose a question.
Good morning. This is Cheryl M. from South Carolina, a recovered and grateful compulsive overeater. So my question is about sponsoring. Mm-hmm. When somebody new to the program asked me to sponsor them, I know to head to the big book with them and work the steps the big book way. Mm-hmm. But I'm never quite sure what to do with a new sponsee who is recovered, who has worked the steps, who is sponsoring themselves. What does a sponsee relationship look like under those circumstances?
I check in with my sponsor every single day. My sponsor lives in Los Angeles, California. Many of you know him. He is a wonderful, wonderful person, and he is just amazing. But what I do is I have people that call me every day that I sponsor that have worked the steps that are sponsoring, and the bottom line is that we check in, how you doing, what's going on, and I ask my sponsees a couple of questions every day. What are you going to do for yourself today? What are you going to do for others? What are you grateful for today? And on occasion, I will ask them, is there something going on that you don't want to tell me? Is there something going on that, you know, we haven't discussed? But I don't work the steps with them per se, but I will check in with them. How's your 10 steps going? How's your 12 steps going? How's your sponsorship going? Things like that. And that's what I do.
Thank you, Cheryl M. Lisa O., your turn.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My name is Lisa O. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in Western Mass. Thank you so much, Layla and Harlan. Thank you very much for being here today. Mike, I have two questions. The first one is, how would you define entire abstinence? And regarding step 10, I've heard you say many times, and also this morning, doing them daily, but I'm very literal. So if I'm not resentful or, you know, angry, you know, the key ones, I tend to not do them. It's important to, regardless of the feelings, just to really sit. And if I'm feeling even the slightest disturbance, should I do the step 10? Those are just the areas that I have been curious about.
I'll take
about.
The second question first. Any time I am of the opinion that I don't need to do a 10-step today, I am in deep denial. Because I don't care what is going on in the world, there are three things happening every single day. Every single day. My disease is getting worse, I'm getting older, and things are changing. So things changing, getting older, my disease getting worse, necessitates daily 10th steps, plural. Not one, but several. There's not a day that goes by where the thought of what I'm scared of, or the thought of what I'm angry about, or the thought of things that necessitate a 10th step will not pervade my consciousness. If you don't feel the need to do a 10th step, perhaps you need to just get in your car and drive for a mile or two and then go home and see if something doesn't pop into your brain. See if something doesn't pop into your head. There are people, Lisa, in your environment right now, I don't have to know you to know this is true. They are not sticking to your script. They are not doing what you think they ought to do. They are not living their lives according to the way you think that they should live their lives. And this is making you upset. You may be sort of numb to it at some point, but the other question I would ask myself is, if I'm feeling so numb that I don't need a 10-step, in my opinion, am I overeating? Am I using a substance to numb out? Because 10-steps are the result of disturbances. And this is something that I need to do not once a day, but several times a day, a million times a day. But when it says continue to watch for selfishness, I'm on page 84, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these things crop up, notice it doesn't say if these things crop up. When these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. That is steps 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately, step 5. It doesn't say we discuss it with them just at night or just in the morning. We discuss it. Doesn't mean I text it. Doesn't mean I email it. Doesn't mean I write it for private consumption. I discuss it with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. So I'm doing step 5, and I'm doing 8, and I'm doing 9. Then we resolutely means with purpose, turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Step 12, love and tolerance of others is our code. So in this little paragraph, I'm working 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12. Very, very important. And so if I am going through days where I'm not doing step 10, I am kidding myself, because I'm getting older. Things are changing, and my disease is getting worse. And if I'm honest with myself, I have need. Entire abstinence to me is defined by me as entirely avoiding completely any food, any substance that is not on my food plan that is triggering my physical allergy. And then for me, it may be different than for you. I don't know. I don't know what your food plan should be. I don't know what it is, and that's okay. That's fine. I am not consuming moderately things that I cannot handle. I don't consume sugar or white flour or white rice. I don't consume ice cream or Reese's peanut butter cups moderately. I abstain from them completely and entirely. Entire abstinence means exactly what it says. I am completely avoidant of any food that I know damn well is going to trigger my physical allergy that should not go in my mouth. And that's my definition of it. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Lisa O., for your question. Nancy L., your turn. Star 1 to unmute.
Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Harlan, for your service this morning. I'm abstinent living in Arizona. I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And my question is this. I have a couple sponsees that I've taken through the 12 steps, and they are now sponsoring. Thanks be to God for that. The thing is that as the time goes by, they contact me less and less and less. I know life, you know, they've got life, they've got jobs, they're sponsoring, et cetera. But do you think that I should just mandate that they call me at a certain time and day every week or what?
I am of the opinion that the sponsor must be the adult in the room. If the sponsor is going to turn control of the relationship over to the sponsee, we are in trouble here. And I know that this can be more challenging for some than for others. I request my sponsees to call me every single day. They have children, or they have grandchildren, or they have jobs, or they have whatever they have. We are all busy people. There's nobody listening on this line right now that is not a busy person with responsibilities and bills to pay and places to go, people to see, what have you. You found the time to eat. You find the time to call your sponsor. And I don't want to hear anything about I'm out of town or I'm this or I'm that. The disease doesn't care. The disease is relentless. Here's a conversation I've never had in my whole life. Gosh, Nancy, I was so busy yesterday, I forgot to overeat. I forgot to binge on chocolate. I was so busy, I never got around to eating those French fries. That's a conversation I've never had. So if it's a day that ends in a Y, I call my sponsor. Nancy's call me. I found the time to eat. I found the time to get the food and eat the food. I find the time to call my sponsor. It is required of me, if I'm to recover, to at least spend as much energy on the recovery as I ever did on the disease. I went to every length imaginable to get that food in my stomach. now it's time for me to spend that energy on myself. So, Nancy, you've got to be the adult in the room. This is what the requirement is, that you call me every day. I don't hold my people to a time. If you need to do that, that's perfectly okay. If they want what you have, they must go to any length to get it. And I hope that helps. Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, Nancy L. Next up, Jeannie B.
Hi, good morning, and thank you, both of you. Harlan, I have a kind of simple question, which is if you could talk to yourself in that first day after that first meeting and tell yourself something that you know now that would help you back then, what would you do? What would you say?
I would tell, that's a good question, Jeannie. I would tell myself to knock off the BS. I would tell myself that life is worth living. I was always a defeatist. I was always a negative thinker. I just wanted to die. From the time I was 4 years old, 5 years old, I was sent a signal by the world. And the world said to me that existentially, you are no good. Existentially, you're weak. You lack willpower. You lack discipline. You will never be anything because of the way you eat. You will never get married. You will never go on a date. You will never get a good job. And for a lot of my life, that was absolutely true. I would say to myself on that first day, it was a Friday night, it was freezing cold in Chicago, it was absolutely miserable, there was an ice storm and very miserable driving conditions. I would say to that Harlan G. in the back of the room at the Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie, Illinois, I would say, you just listen to what these people say, because I was looking at my shoes, judging them. I was 30 years younger than anybody in that room. I was 300-400 pounds fatter than anybody in that room, and I needed to knock off the BS. I needed to listen to what they were saying and embrace what they were saying and do what they were telling me to do. It took me a long time. On December the 29th of last year, which is just a few days ago, I got my 26 years of abstinence. But what I should have done that first night, if I was smart, if I knew, you know, like to answer your question, I would say to myself, you jump in here with both feet. You're 24 years old. You got your whole life in front of you. You don't have to die. You don't have to live a miserable life. Now, it would be 11 more years till I was 35 that I went on my first date with a girl. It would be many more years before I would be flush financially. It would be a long time before I would have anything like a normal weight, a normal body. But the bottom line is, I would have told myself, instead of fighting these people and judging these people, instead of putting them in a box and saying they're stupid, they're this, I can't do this, say, how do I do this? Take my hand, show me, I am going to be open to what you tell me. I would tell myself, life is worth living, and don't you miss a minute of it, because this is it. This is not a dress rehearsal. And that's what I would have told myself, Jeannie. And I wish to God I would have, and I wish I would have listened. It took me years to grow up in this program. Thank God I'm living today, but that's what I would have told myself.
Thank you, Jeannie B. Next, we have Deb S. Your question, please.
Hi, Leah. It's great to hear your voice. And Harlan, it's wonderful to hear you. This is Deb S., recovered compulsive eater in Michigan. So I'm kind of like Jeannie, going back to an earlier time and something that you mentioned, Harlan, when you talked about somebody pulling you. I think you said something like pulling you by the ear to get you in. And I'm just wondering, you know, we say, we'll, not really promote it, but share our experience, strength, and hope in that. But that there's so many people who maybe probably need a little bit more encouragement. So I was just wondering, how did that go for you when, I don't know if they literally pulled you by the ear or what, but how did they encourage you to come in? And why do you think that worked and that you did listen to what they say and stay? Because you were 24, you had an option to not. So I was just wondering that.
I had nobody in this world. My mother died when I was 22. My father died when I was 24. This was just weeks after my father died. I had nobody. I owed a lot of money. These were extremely important people in my life, as they were the only family, I'm reticent to use the word because we're not related, they were the only family I really had. They were my good friends. And they muscled me into coming against my will. Does that mean that you're going to muscle people into coming in here? Probably not. Probably not. I was amenable to it, but I didn't do what they were telling me to do in the meetings. I wasn't abstinent, or I'd be abstinent for a few days here, and then I would eat, and I'd be abstinent for a few weeks, and then I would eat. It was dieting with group support. And the best thing I can remember is today is we are all carrying a message, and some of us are carrying a message of recovery, and some of us are cautionary tales that tell people that this does not work. Everybody in this world is carrying a message. And when I was a little younger than I am today, going back 30 years, actually 23 years, 24 years, I was blessed to be a father. My daughter lives in Brooklyn, New York, and she lives in a place called Crown. It's either Crown Heights or Crown Point. There's Crown Point, Indiana. Crown something. I think it's Crown Heights, but don't quote me. And when she was a little girl, in relapse, and she was 18 months old. We were living in Eugene, Oregon at that time. And my daughter was, it is right now, and my daughter was in the kitchen, and I was sitting and talking to my then wife, and she had just bought half the grocery store and was putting stuff away. And my little daughter, in her diaper, she reached up to the refrigerator, and she opened the refrigerator a few inches, and she turned to her mother and said, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." I wonder where she learned that. Shit, Esther, there's nothing in the refrigerator? I think she learned that by watching Daddy. I think she did. A number of years later, I was in beautiful recovery, just beautiful recovery. And we were watching a show on television called My Name is Earl. It's on ABC. It was about a brother, a guy and his brother who won the lottery, and they had been robbers. They stole from people, and they were going around restituting the people they had robbed. She looked at the premiere episode for 2 seconds, looked at me, looked at the TV, looked at me, and said, "Those guys are just doing their eighth and ninth step, right, Dad?" And without a word from me, I understood where she was coming from, because she was following my example. She was following what it was that she saw me doing. You're not going to go out and revolutionize the world, a la Bill Wilson. He tried that, and it failed. It is up to us, Deb, to be the best examples of what this can be or what it is to anybody that's interested. But we're not going to probably be successful dragging people in by the ear. It's probably not going to work. So just be a good example, and the world needs less lecturers and less managers and more good examples. Be one of those, and that's about as much as we can do.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
Thank you. Thank you, Deb. Okay, great opportunity to pose questions this morning. You can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name as well as the first letter of your last name.
Maggie.
Diana Y.
A.
Maggie A.
Alexis F.
Alexis F.
Kate P.
Lorraine F.
Kate P. Lorraine F.
No, it's Elaine F.
Elaine F. Thank you.
Yes.
Linda G. in Mobile, Alabama.
Linda G.
Debbie S.
Debbie S. Thus far, I have Maggie A., Diane, I didn't catch your last
Chris
initial.
G. in Tennessee.
G. Alexis F., K., Katie P., Elaine S., Linda G., and Debbie S. Who did I miss?
Did you get Linda G.?
Yes.
Chris B.
Great.
Is that Chris B.?
Chris G. in Tennessee.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, let's start with Maggie A. Your question, please.
Yes, hello. I'm Maggie A. from Massachusetts. I'm fairly new to the program, and my question is, well, let me just say I've always had a sweet tooth as a child, but and I have now some health issues, autoimmune, that make it very hard for me to even keep my weight on. I have to, you know, make sure I get enough calories. But the reason I came to program is because I do crave sugar. And it's also, my doctor says, due to a yeast overgrowth, candida. But and I've started the steps with a sponsor a couple times. And my problem is I start having doubts saying, oh, I feel too limited. And, you know, obviously, and I don't want to do it because I want that sugar. But what keeps me in doubt and keeps stopping me getting in my way is that I don't overeat. I'm happy with just small amounts of sugar. I can stop. I just, you know, one cookie after lunch, one cookie after dinner. But I really want that small amount. But that's all it ever is. So that's what kind of makes me wonder if I'm truly a compulsive overeater or not. So
I
wonder if you can speak to that. Thank you.
I cannot diagnose you. This is a self-diagnosing disease. The only person on earth that can tell Maggie A. whether or not you are a compulsive overeater is you. I am not qualified to diagnose anyone. But what I can say is, if you want to know are you a compulsive overeater or not, I would just ask you to do this. What is your favorite binge food in the world? When you go crazy on sugar or whatever it is, what do you want to go crazy on? What's your fantasy food?
Well, I don't binge. That's the thing. I just have the small, you know, I just have a steady small amount of sugar and I'm happy.
I really don't know. I cannot diagnose another human being. It is a self-diagnosing disease.
Right.
If you believe that you are a compulsive overeater, then I would work these steps like, you know, your life depends upon it. If you believe that you are not, I will just only say this. This, in my opinion, and I do not have scientific backing for this, so don't throw this out at me. I am just giving you my opinion. This is a spectrum disorder. In my opinion, based on 45 years of observation, thousands and thousands of meetings, and tens of thousands of people coming in and out, we are affected identically, but we are not affected equally. I don't know if that helps you, but I cannot diagnose you. The only one that can diagnose you is you. I cannot pass any judgment on whether Maggie is or is not a compulsive overeater. I just can't do it. I can't do it. So I'm sorry I can't be more helpful, but your experience does not sound like mine. I eat a cookie. I eat a Hershey bar. I eat whatever, you know, I'm off to the races. That doesn't sound like you. That doesn't mean you're not a compulsive overeater. It just means you're not one that I relate to. So, again, let's move on. I'm sorry I can't be a little more helpful, Maggie, but the only one that can diagnose you is Maggie. Thanks.
Thank you, Maggie. Diana Y., your turn.
Diana,
why? Star one to unmute.
Oh, hi. Harlan, how do you do your 10th step?
I do it right out of the big book on page 84. When it's on page 84, it says, I'm looking at the middle, because I do 4 steps, you know, every once in a while. If there's something that's nagging at me, I do a 4-step. But it says here, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That is what it's, if you're looking at page 84, when these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Anytime it says ask, it means pray. So I say the 7-step prayer. I say the 7-step prayer, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And then what does it say is we discuss it with someone immediately. I don't always call my sponsor. I have a God squad. And I have people that I call and I say, oh, I'm upset about this, or oh, I'm scared about that. And then we talk about it for just a second, and we talk about it. Then I make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. You know, and then I resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. I do it right out of the big book. I don't text them. I don't email them. That's not what it says. I do it as it says in the big book on page 84. If someone has another way of doing them, I'm not into it because I'm going to do my program right out of the big book. And that's how I do it.
Thank you, Harlan.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Diana. Next, Alexis F. Star 1 to unmute.
Thank you, Harlan. Thank you, Leah. This may seem like a silly question, but I drink water all day. And I have an oral fixation. I'm abstinent. I weigh and measure. It's just the water. I'm in a wheelchair, and it takes my daughter a long time to keep taking me back and forth to the bathroom. So it affects other people. And it affects me. Do you suggest I measure it?
Drink less water. I don't know what to tell you. Alexis, I drink a gallon a day. I live in the hottest part of the country. I live in a desert, and I drink a lot of water. It helps me. But if it's not helping you, don't do it. I mean, you got to do what you got to do, right? I don't know what to
tell
you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Alexis.
Thank you. Katie P., your turn. Katie.
Hi, Harlan. My name is Kate P., and my question is about when the resentment is about yourself. You know, you said that emotions trump intellect, and when you're restless, irritable, and discontent, and it has to do with feelings about yourself, you know, you're further along, you've done the steps of, you know, blaming other people. Now it's more of an internal. Anything that you can, any tips about that internal resentment? Thank you.
The internal resentment will alleviate if you continue working the steps and get out of yourself, and you get out of yourself by doing 10s, 11s, and 12s. The steps will make you right with yourself, right with God, and right with your fellow human being. I'm reminded of page 570 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is part of appendix number 3, the medical view on AA. I'm in the 4th edition of the big book of AA, and it says on page 570, Alcoholics Anonymous are no crusaders, not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, the weeks into months and years. Here is what I learned. For me, this is a disease of self-loathing. It is not the only factor of the disease, but it is a major factor. and the self-loathing that I lived with my entire life, the doubt, the fear, the anxiety that I lived in my entire life were killing me. They were trapping me into the food, but they were doing other things besides trapping me into the food. They were trapping me into very negative thinking. I never thought I deserved anything in life. When I was a little boy, maybe 7, maybe 8, most of my father's friends, not all of them, but most of my father's friends came out of the concentration camps of Europe and the DP camps. If you don't know what a DP camp is, it was just a displaced persons camp. That's what it stands for. Lots of marriages in there, lots of stuff like that too. But anyway, they came out of the DP camps and the concentration camps. And they would all, even though they may not have known each other, they would all kiss my cheek and they would pat my cheek and say, "Live until you die." And I thought living until I die meant I'm going to eat as many Reese's peanut butter cups and as many Hostess Twinkies as I can. It doesn't mean that at all. It means you live your fullest life. When I would catch a glimpse of myself in a mirror or a store window, I would loathe the image that I saw. It was fat. It was grotesque. It wasn't attractive. It was lonely. I had a lot of pain, physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. I had all kinds of pains and all kinds of situations. I could barely walk. I couldn't stand. I hated myself. I hated life, and I hated God. Without deliberately attacking any of those things, I like myself now, not in a narcissistic, imbecilic way, but I like myself now. I respect myself now. I am honest. I didn't lie to anybody today. I didn't lie to anybody yesterday or the day before or the day before that or the day before that. I'm not doing things that make me loathe myself anymore. I pay my bills. I am a forthright, above board, open human being. How did that happen? It didn't happen because I decided one day to be that kind of person. It happened because I got out of myself and I worked the steps. Life is precious. It's the most precious commodity known to mankind. It is life. And I don't have to spend my life, Katie, hating myself. I don't have to spend my life today in self-doubt and in self-pity. Sometimes I have bouts of self-pity. Sometimes I have doubts of shame, guilt, remorse. I'm a human being. I'm not immune to those things. But as I get out of myself and as I start helping others, I gain a healthy respect for myself. And I gain a passion and love for God that I never thought possible. And in holding God's hands, all these things clear up, and they are clear today. I have a good relationship with myself. I have a good relationship with my friends. Maybe there's people, not maybe, there's definitely people out there that don't like me. Last night, I slept like a baby. It's okay. Unless I have harmed you in some way and I owe you an amends, your opinion of me is none of my business. And one of the other things, and I'll touch on this very briefly, Kate, is it Kate or Katie? Kate or Katie?
Kate.
All right. Kate. Okay, I don't want to call you by the wrong name. Kate, I'll touch on this very briefly. What other people think of me is none of my business. And what would often happen to me is if this guy didn't like me or that gal rejected me or this, but whatever it is, oh, it would send me into a tailspin. I am pretty much immune from that today. You don't like me, that's your business. I can love you, but that may mean that there is a path for you and a path for me, and it doesn't have to be the same path. And that's where a lot of my self-hatred came from. I wanted everybody to love me. Guess what? Nobody likes everybody, and nobody is liked by everybody. I was told years ago, 20% of the people that meet you, they're going to like you. 20% of the people that meet you, they're not going to like you. And the 60% in the middle, baby, you ain't even registering on their radar. Just go live your life. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Kate P. Elaine F., you're next.
star one to unmute.
Elaine?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Elaine?
Sorry. Now we can hear you.
I'm sorry, did you call Elaine S?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Okay. I'm so sorry. Harlan, thank you so much. As always, you are just so inspiring, and your willingness to do all the things you do are just, you know, such a gift from God for all of us.
Thank you.
What I want to ask you is, earlier you mentioned that you want your sponsees to call you every day,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly understand that when we're working, when we're taking somebody through the steps. But afterwards, I'm sure you've sponsored, you know, hundreds of people. Do you have every single one of those people call you every day? I mean, how do you
some
manage
of them
that?
Do
I don't
some
quite
of
understand
them don't.
That.
You know, our friend Kim G in New Jersey, she has a saying. She says, we come in by the hundreds and leave by the 99s. Many, many, many of the people that I have sponsored are either in the food or unknown to me, are in recovery, and they've stopped calling. I can't demand that you call, or I can't enforce that you call. I can only request it. And some of them have stopped, and I haven't heard from them in many, many years. Haven't seen them in a meeting, haven't heard from them, nothing. So I can only brand the cattle that are in the pen. I cannot do any more than that. So if they're not here and they don't call, you know what they say, Elaine? The dogs bark, but the wagon train continues. They don't all call me because they're not all in recovery, or they're calling someone else. I don't think about it much.
Thank you, Elaine S., for your question. Next up, Linda G.
Harlan, thank you so much for your service. my question is, I am a former dancer, and I'm going to the ballet Tuesday night. Have you ever had body dysmorphia? And if so, what do you do about it?
I've had body dysmorphia from the day I was born. I looked at a 335-pound senior in high school that had a stomach hanging down. I had a body that was emasculated by the fat around my area. I looked at that body and I saw Sean Connery. I saw the man from Uncle. I'm going to date myself here. The man from Uncle. Or I saw a movie star. I saw whatever. And then I lost a lot of weight later in my life, and I saw Dumbo the elephant, and I saw the 700-pound guy. So, yes, I have body dysmorphia. That's why, one of the reasons, that's not why, but that's one of the reasons that every single Friday I weigh myself. I get on that scale, and I look at the number, and I text myself, how much do I weigh? I let the scale tell me the truth. Hey, how am I doing? What's going on? And the doctors will tell me you're okay or you're not okay. But it's been years since a doctor has raised their voice to me screaming about my lack of willpower, screaming about my lack of character. And that just doesn't happen to me anymore. There's another thing in my life, too, that is very exciting. Yes, I still have bubby arms. If you don't know what bubby arms are, I have fat hanging from my bicep, my tricep, and it's unsightly, and I wish I didn't have it. I'm not going to go get plastic surgery. I have thunder thighs. Thanks, Mom. Yeah, but I have her thunder thighs. I have areas of my body that could really use some plastic surgery or something. But I do the best I can. I exercise every day. I work my program, and this is what helps me. And just as I've told people before, the self-loathing, the body dysmorphia, get out of yourself is what I was told, and it works. When I get out of myself and I help other people, and I don't have this obsessive concentration on my thunder thighs or my bubby arms or the fat around my back or whatever it is, because you can't put 700 pounds on a frame and think that there's not going to be consequences. There's going to be physical consequences. I don't look so much like the other guys. But here's what I can tell you. When I see a picture of myself with my friends, I look younger than most of them. I don't have a hanging stomach. Now, I've had extensive plastic surgery around that area, but I don't have a hanging stomach. I don't look any different than the best of them. I really don't. What's the secret to it, Linda? Get out of yourself, get out of yourself, get out of yourself, and go help other people, and this stuff will disappear from your consciousness. Let's move on. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Linda G. Debbie F., your turn.
Debbie F. is Frank.
I have it as Sam, but I could
Sam,
be wrong.
Okay.
Debbie.
Oh, I'll just, Debbie's fine. Debbie's fine. All right, Debbie, what do you got?
We're looking for a Debbie.
That would be a good title of a movie, Looking for Debbie.
Hi, this is Debbie S. Yeah, I'm in the chapter We Agnostics, and I was wondering if you could explain to me the difference between agnostic temperament and the bedevilments.
The difference between agnostic temperament and the bedevilments. Boy, that's a tough one. First of all, what is an agnostic? An agnostic is not an atheist. Most people think it's an atheist. It's not. An agnostic is someone who doesn't have enough knowledge one way or the other. Ag means without, gnostic means knowledge. So they don't have enough knowledge to make a decision yet as to whether or not they believe. Now, what is also apparent in many, many compulsive overeaters, and I think it's apparent in all human beings to some degree or another, is even though I am a believer in God, I have no doubt that there is a God, and I do not doubt that that God loves me. Let's take a look, though, at some things very briefly here. All that's required here is that you be willing to believe, or that you believe that there is a power greater than yourself. And if you're willing to believe, you don't have to believe, you're willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself, you're on your way to recovery. Now, I want to talk for just a second, even though you didn't really ask me about this, about pockets of agnosticism. What is a pocket of agnosticism? I'm going to sort of use your question, Debbie, as an excuse to work this into this morning's presentation. A pocket of agnosticism is arising when I know that there's a God, but I'm not quite sure that this problem with my business is going to come out to my liking, so I'm not going to give this to God. I'm going to hold on to this myself. Or I'm not quite sure that this romantic entanglement is going to go the way I want it to go, so I'm going to hang on to it myself. I'm not going to give it to God because I'm afraid that if I do, I won't get the results that I really, really want. So a pocket of agnosticism it comes from this pocket of doubt that if I give this to God, is it going to be what I want it to be? And if I think that it might not, I will probably hold on to it. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I forgot your original question. You asked me something about the bedevilments. What is the difference between an agnostic and the bedevilments? Was that it? Or straighten me out here.
Yeah, Debbie? That was my question. The difference
between... an agnostic and the bedevilments? Well, an agnostic is someone who lacks the knowledge of whether or not there is a God. Ag means without, gnostic means knowledge. The bedevilments is a mutually exclusive situation that has nothing to do with the definition of agnostics. The bedevilments are on page 52. And they are sort of like the anti-promises. They're not attached to a definition of agnosticism. They are the things that happen when we malinger in the disease. And here's what the bedevilments are. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. That comes from selfishness, and it comes from self-seeking, fear, anger. These are the character defects. It doesn't have to do necessarily with agnosticism. There are believers and atheists who have trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Once again, doesn't bear out to the definition of agnosticism, but what it does is, if I'm in the disease and I'm plagued by the five character defects. There's only five character defects: selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, resentment, fear. Those are the defects of character. Selfish, self-seeking, resentment, fear, and dishonesty. Those are the only character defects that we're dealing with here. A woman called me up not long ago. She says, I have 107 character defects. I said, you absolutely do not. You have five. And the other ones are behaviors that emanate from those character defects. Being late for work, yelling at your husband, yelling at your wife, not doing your tasks at work or at school, those are not character defects. Those are behaviors that emanate from character defects. But let's stick to your question. We were a prey to misery and depression. There are rabbis, there are priests, there are ministers, there are atheists that are a prey to misery and depression. You don't have to be an agnostic. We couldn't make a living. Again, human condition in the disease. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? So the bedevilments do not really attach themselves in any way to the definition of an agnostic. The bedevilments come from the defects of character which ego gives birth to. That's human condition in the disease. I hope that helps, because it's not really connected. Okay? Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you, Debbie S. Chris G., your turn.
Chris G.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, Harlan, I wanted to ask about getting along with family members and maybe the difference with a step 10 with a family member and with the maybe a step 10 with everybody.
Well, I don't know why a step 10 would be different for a family member than for anybody. I don't really quite understand why.
Okay, then I want to know how you get along with family members.
Well, you're asking someone that really doesn't have a family, but here's how I get along with people. You have to be accepting of them, and you have to be love and tolerance of others is our code. What does it say in step 10 at the end? Love and tolerance of others is our code. And I have to read that acceptance every single day, in, you know, as part of my life. I never, you know, let a day go by without going to page 416 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, fourth edition. And what does it say? And what does it say? It says, at last, acceptance proved to be the key to my drinking problem. I won't read the whole thing here. You can read this yourself. But sometimes, and acceptance doesn't mean approval. I'm not here to approve of you. Maybe you're wearing a green shirt, and I think you should be wearing a black shirt. Maybe you're wearing red pants, and I think you should be wearing blue pants, whatever. I don't know. Acceptance doesn't mean approval. But if every person in my environment is annoying me, I got to stop looking at them and start looking at myself. What the heck is going on with me? Because you know what they say in AA? You meet three jerks in a day, it's you. You meet three jerks in a day, it's me. Well, I got to look at me, because love and tolerance of others is our code, and I hope that helps, Chris.
Thank you, Harlan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We still have time for more questions. If you'd like to pose a question, star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Margaret D., Georgia.
Margaret D.
Susan P., Georgia.
Susan P.
Michelle C.
Michelle C.
Judy N., Maryland.
Judy N. One or two more.
Barbara P.
Barbara P.
Sherry S. in Nevada.
And Sherry S. Okay, let's stop there. Margaret D., go ahead with your question, please.
Thanks, Leah. Hey, Harlan. Good morning.
Good morning,
it's really a pretty quick one. Good morning. Even though you don't have a wife and you don't have a family and you may or may not be an employer, I don't know. How do you utilize those chapters 8, 9, and 10, even though you may not fit exactly into that, any of those categories?
Those categories are really easy to fit to my life because those categories I interpret as being about sponsoring. When I'm working with others, I look to two wives as a tremendous, tremendous sponsorship tool. Because remember that the 12th step is practice these principles in all of our affairs. So what are affairs? The wife, the family, the employer. I'm not here to govern what other people do. I'm not here to control what other people do. And if you look at two wives, you look at the family afterwards, it's teaching me how to get along with people, what to do and what not to do. And so these chapters are extremely poignant in my life. And I do a Saturday morning big book study every Saturday, and I have a lot of podcasts that come up out of that. And I cover these chapters, and what I stress in these chapters is this is really about the human condition, but it's about sponsorship. It's really, it says, you know, it categorizes different things. It tells me when a discussion does arise, you might suggest that he read this book or at least a chapter on alcoholism. You know, these are things that are specific instructions. So that's how I do it. It teaches me how to get along with people. It teaches me what to do and what not to do. And not only does it help my sponsoring, Margaret, it helps me in my daily life with other people, not to force my ideas, to force my opinions on other people, that God has his timing, and I must be respectful of God's timing. Very, very important. Thanks for the question. That's a good one.
Thanks, Margaret D. Susan P., your turn.
Susan.
Hi, Harlan.
Hi, Susan.
A fellow Skokian. I would like to go back to the five character defects, and I think you mentioned selfishness and self-centeredness.
Selfish, self-seeking. I'll explain. That's a very common question. The most common question asked on vision is, can I be heard? May I be heard? That's number one. The next most important question, or the next most frequently asked question, is what is the difference between recovered and recovering? And then there's what's the difference between selfish? The script I have in my head. I want you to stick to my script. I want you to live your life according to my script. Self-seeking is the action that I take to get you to stick to my script. In other words, manipulation. I want to manipulate you either through kindness or cruelty. I want to manipulate you so that you will indeed stick to my script. So once again, very quickly, Susan, the difference between selfish and self-seeking is selfish is the script, self-seeking is the manipulative tools I use to get you to stick to that script. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Susan. Michelle C.
Thank you very much.
Your turn.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Michelle C.
Hi, thank you so much for your service. My question is, I'm relatively new to OA, and one of the things that's hit me recently is like, oh, what I've been looking for all along is a relationship with God, with a higher power. Can you kind of help me think about how to reconnect with my higher power throughout the day and develop a relationship?
Pray and give gratitude and help others. You're new. Where are you in the step process?
I'm just at reading Bill's story, so I'm at the very beginning.
So you're in step one. Okay, you should be sponsoring relatively soon. And until that time, make outreach calls. Make somebody else's day. Get out of yourself. Count your blessings on an everyday basis. It takes 5 minutes every day at the end of the day. Ask yourself a question. What am I grateful for today? What did I see today that was beautiful? Oh, I saw the sunset. Oh, I saw a puppy. Oh, I saw this. I saw that. And that imbues me with this awe of God and his mighty power. Get out of yourself, Michelle. Get out of yourself. Get out of yourself, and you will find vistas of life you never dreamed possible. It is the best thing I can do for myself on a daily basis is get out of myself and give to others. Not in a sick way, not in a manipulative way, but in a healthy way. What's the difference? If I'm doing something for you and I expect a result, that's not healthy giving. That's manipulation. I know how to give you things, and if I give you things and you're supposed to now stick to my script because you owe me, that's not giving. That's manipulating. Give freely of yourself with no expectation of a return. There's no quid pro quo in this world. You do this and I'll do that. Give and let it go, and you'll find that this will clear. This will be right there for you.
Thank you, Michelle C. Judy N. Star 1 to unmute.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you, Harlan, for sharing your wisdom this morning. And I've learned so much from you and your podcast that I recorded. My question is, we talk, and there's so much I have, but you say give love yourself. I'm living in recovery. My program, of course, I'm a work in progress. There are areas of living in 10, 11, and 12 that I know I need to improve on.
We're all in the same boat, Judy.
Okay. My question is this. When you say give of yourself, mm-hmm. I feel that I have changed. I feel this transformation. It'll be 3 years for me living in 10, 11, and 12 in a few months. I know my perspective has changed. I finally know how to take care of myself because growing up, I never had boundaries. It was all about here. You want it? I don't need it. You take it. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know anything really. So now I'm learning what does it mean, self-respect? So
I see myself as a child of God. I see myself as the product of my parents, and I want to respect myself.
Right. So that means I can say now I'm not available to help.
If you're not available, you're not available. You don't have to
without
be all
feeling
things to all
guilt
people.
And shame.
Sometimes no is the healthiest answer you can give.
Okay. So let's talk about quickly my real question. My children, I know I failed them as a parent, mm-hmm. not materially, but as a communicator, actor, as a teacher, I just didn't have those skills. So I made my amends. I attempted to make my amends. And still, I'm not getting any, what I would say, respect. When,
you're
you know,
looking to other people.
From
to,
one of my children.
You're looking for something you can't look for. You're looking for them to get something from you so that they will stick to your script and respect you according to your wishes. That is not going to happen in this lifetime. You have got to give up yourself.
That.
I'm sorry?
So what do you do if you have a son?
You live your life and you recover. There's three things you should do today. You may want to write them down. Recover, recover, and recover. Those are the three things you can do today. Recover, recover, and recover. If you're going to look to make amends to your children and have them respect you in a way that is okay with you, you are going to play with fire. You're going to be in trouble. We just got through talking about this. You cannot give anything with any expectation of a result. You give or don't. But your children are not yours anymore. They're not yours anymore. They belong to God. In Hebrew, the word for parent is the same word as bailment. You know what a bailment is? You have possession without title. you park your car in a parking lot. You park your car in a parking lot. Do they have possession of your car? Yes. Do they own your car? No. So the bottom line is, drop your expectations. They are premeditated resentments, and you need to work on this with your sponsor. I'm not here to give you parenting advice. I'm here to help you with OA, but that's, you know, that's parenting advice too. But the bottom line is, drop your expectations and go recover, recover, and recover. And whatever happens, happens. It's not up to us. Thanks, Judy, for your question. I hope that helps.
Thank you. Next up, Barbara P.
Barbara P. Okay.
Star 1 to unmute, Barbara.
Hey, this is Barbara P., compulsive overeater. Quick question, Harlan. How do you define step 1?
I define step 1 as the powerless condition of mind and body. I define that powerlessness. We admitted we were powerless over food, and our lives have become unmanageable. I define it as the starting point. And if I'm powerless and I have this disease, then I need to do what's in front of me. And what I always tell people is this: the depth at which I accept the doctor's opinion will mark the urgency with which I will work the remaining 11 steps. There are, these chapters are about step one, doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, and more about alcoholism. These are all chapters, even though the story of step two is in Bill's story and how Bill worked all the steps is in there, but these are chapters about step one. And the definition I have of step one is, it is the condition of mind and body that necessitates a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Nothing of this earth gave me this disease. Nobody gave me this disease of compulsive overeater. Nothing gave me this disease. No condition, no human, nothing. The only thing that gave me this is just biology. And the only thing that's going to alleviate this, not cure it, is God. We have an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I'm probably never going to have a spiritual experience, but I can have a spiritual awakening. Ah, what's the difference? Spiritual experience is very fast, very sudden, and a spiritual awakening is slower. That's all. But on the last page of More About Alcoholism, which is page 43, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. This is the sentence to pay attention to above everything else. His defense must come from a higher power. I define it as the definition of the disease. All right, I hope that helps.
Thank you, Barbara P. And our final question this morning comes from Sherry W. Sherry?
Hi.
Yes.
I think you can hear me now. Thank you. Thank you, Harlan.
Yes.
I've heard you speak in the past and just want to thank you. I think you're like an icon for the rest of us.
Thank you.
And I've heard you say that everyone should go through the steps as quickly as possible. I've actually
Correct.
Heard you say anywhere between 7 and 10 days. Could you explain the rationale to me?
Okay. On page 89 of
that,
the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it gives you the ultimate promise. The page 89 promise that it gives you is in Working with Others, and it says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking. Isn't that what we're looking for, is immunity from eating? As intensive work with other alcoholics. A lot of times you see people, they want to make this into a college course or a master's program. You've got the rest of your life to be in these rooms. You've got the rest of your life to study and learn and expand your knowledge. But the most important thing that I can do is to get through this as quickly as I can and start sponsoring other people. Let's take a couple of quick examples because of time. Dr. Bob called on Bill Dotson with Bill Wilson on June the 26th, 1935. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Bob didn't get sober on June the 10th. But let's just for the sake of this little scenario here, assume that 16 days have passed since Bob got sober. How many people listening to this right now were out sponsoring 16 days after getting sober? Not that many. Now let's take a look at something else that's very, very apparent, and it comes up in the story of Bill Dotson, It comes up in the story of Jimmy Burwell, the atheist. And Jimmy Burwell talks about the fact that his sponsor, this is on page 226, this is 226 in the fourth edition. It says, this was the background that made me willing to listen on January 8th. After being dry 2 weeks and sticking close to Jackie, all of a sudden I found I had become the sponsor of my sponsor, for he was suddenly taken drunk. I was startled to learn that he had only been off the booze a month or so himself when he brought me the message. So in other words, Jimmy Burwell was sponsoring somebody 2 weeks after he got sober, and his sponsor had only been sober a couple of months, and he was sponsoring. Now, I am not here to cast aspersions on anybody. You sponsor the way you do, it's none of my business. In my opinion, now again, this is my opinion, sometimes we can get a little too pedantic, a little too detailed in some of the things, and we don't have to have a perfect understanding of what does it mean when we say spiritual progress rather than spiritual progress. We don't have to have a perfect understanding of anything here to sponsor. We just have to go through it. We have to be abstinent, and then we can pass on. And we can ask each other. There's three reasons people are afraid to sponsor, or two reasons. Number one, they're afraid they won't do it perfectly. And number two, they're afraid the people won't like them or they won't get the result. There are three, the results. We're not in the results business. I'm not here for you to like me. And nobody does it perfectly. There's only one perfect sponsor, and that's God. God is the only perfect sponsor. And you know what? I'm not in the results business. If they want to recover, I can't say the wrong thing. If they don't want to recover, I can't say the right thing. So that's why I go through very quickly. I make sure you have a basic understanding of the chapter, and we move on. And then later on, we can fill in the blanks together, but we need to get you out there sponsoring. Okay? I hope that answers it, Sherry.
Thank you, Sherry, for your question. And, of course, thank you to everyone who posed questions this morning. And a great big thank you to you, Harlan, for all you do. Thank you for this instructive and valuable time together this morning. Share ID for today's presentation and Q&A, 22,053. That's 22,053. We will now close the meeting from page 164, found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.